Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Thriving Minds podcast. I'm Professor Selena Bartlett. Today, we have the honour of having Hugh Mackay on the podcast. I'm sure most of you know him. For those that don't, he's a social researcher and an author. He's written a large number of books, and I'm going to put links to all of those. And we're going to talk about many subjects that he's really passionate about. So welcome, Hugh. Thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Thank you very much, Selena. It's a great pleasure.
So please tell us a little bit, give us a brief overview of what led you to become a psychologist, a social researcher, and a writer.
All of those things were somewhat accidental, I regret to say. I'd love to be able to tell you that from the age of 10, I was passionate about becoming what I became, but that's not the case. I still remember the day I walked out the school gate with not the faintest idea what I would do, what would happen to me. I had a Christmas holiday job in a retailer, and then my family made it clear that I would have to go to work. I was only 16 when I left school. I'd have to go to work. There would be no such luxury as full-time study. But I got a job in a public opinion research organization. This is 1955, when public opinion research was absolutely in its infancy in Australia. And I was absolutely hooked on that because as a child and an adolescent, I'd always been a curious-minded person. I always wanted to know what made people tick and why things worked the way they did. And I loved being an observer. I remember hours and hours of childhood spent sitting in a tree near where I lived, just watching the passing parade. I loved that. Not that I was friendless, I wasn't an isolate, but I did love being on my own watching. And then when I got into this job, I realized I could actually make a career out of watching and try to understand why people do what they do. So that then led me to undertake an arts degree in psychology and philosophy as an evening student while I was still working in research. And again, once I got into social psychology and began to see the links between my daily employment and the business of social psychology, I really became very committed to the idea that even though a lot of these projects that I was working on were commercial projects, like studying the behavior of media audiences or people's voting intentions or whatever it might be, it was all part of the puzzle of why people do what they do, what makes us tick. So I just devoted my working life. I suppose the underlying driver, once I got a bit older and understood a bit better what I was doing, was can I help to explain people to themselves? And that's why towards the end of my career, when I was 55 before my first book was published, that was a book called Reinventing Australia, 1993, 30 years ago. But that book was my first attempt to say to the general reader, here's what's going on. This is how Australia is changing. This is why we feel the way we feel. And the response to that was very encouraging and has encouraged me to go on writing. I'm no longer doing hands-on research. I've spent most of my working life sitting in people's lounge rooms, listening to them tell me their stories, but I'm not doing that anymore. And I'm almost at the end of my writing career, but the writing was an extension of the work as a researcher. Someone once said of me in introducing me, and this is the bloke who explains us to ourselves, and I thought that was I'd quite like that on my headstone.
Fantastic. I just want to say that Hugh and I are also part of a documentary series about this called The Great Separation that we hope will be coming out soon. Mm. And talks a lot about what we can do and takes an amazing young man, Joey, on an expedition to what happened when he was lonely and then what he did to overcome that. So it's a beautiful way of telling this whole story too.
Mm.
So Hugh, I've just got to know for people listening straight away, what has been some of the greatest revelations? What made you write that book in 93, for example, at that point?
Yes. Well, in 1993, Australia was entering a very troubled period. Anxiety levels were rising. We were beginning to see the early signs of what became our epidemics of depression and loneliness and so on. So that was an attempt really to say, look what happens to a society when it's going through major upheavals. At that time, the major upheavals had been the gender revolution, the information technology revolution, and the restructure of the Australian economy. Those three things had had a dramatic, I mean, we had unemployment levels higher than we'd had since the Great Depression of the 1930s. So a lot of people were deeply troubled, anxious, and bewildered. So the book was an attempt to say, look, this is what's been happening. I think if I think about the most positive and most negative of the big changes that led me to write that and subsequently, in fact, more recently, I think the big accomplishments in Australian society that I've been tracking over all this time have been particularly our final embrace of multiculturalism. When I grew up, I was born just before World War II, so I grew up in the post-war immigration period when we were a dreadfully prejudiced society. We talked about refos and, you know, displaced persons, and then we started talking about new Australians as if that was a polite term. So there was a lot of very ugly prejudice, and we've lived through that, we've grown through it, and now we value the fact that we've got people who've come here from more than 200 birthplaces around the world and created what is arguably the world's most harmonious multi-ethnic multicultural society. So I think it's been a privilege to document that process. I think we got further to go with this one, but also with the gender revolution. I think when I think again about the years of growing up and the early years of my working life, when it was just taken for granted, even by women, that women were second-class citizens in our society, that women would automatically be paid less than men. Why? Why? Because they are women. No other reason needed. Women who worked for the public service and got married had to resign. You couldn't have a married woman taking a permanent position in the public service. That was only for breadwinners, and that meant men or single women. So we've come a long, long way. We've been through, I was privileged to be doing all this social research during the 70s and 80s and 90s when the whole gender revolution really gathered serious momentum. We're not there yet, but when you can compare today with what it was like in the early years of my research career, it's like a miracle. And we're within sight, I think, of understanding what gender equality really will look like. And I think it's within reach. I hope in my lifetime we're going to see this off the agenda, because it'll just be an accepted part of our way of life.
And so that's the beauty of being a researcher, isn't it? And having this life experience, it's always really, really powerful to be able to reflect, isn't it? Because sometimes we lose sight when we're in the moment now, and you're feeling like it's nothing's going to change, or like if you're someone born now, you don't understand just how big those changes have been. So when you were in your early career, you probably never could imagine that we would be sitting here having this conversation on a podcast together. For example.
Well, the word podcast, of course, is a very new word. And in fact, when I began my research career, it was pre-television, pre-computers. And so all data analysis was done by hand, meticulous pencil and paper, and much use of the eraser. I could not have imagined, but even Even in the early 90s, Selena, after I'd been, you know, working for all those decades and documenting all this, even in the early 90s, I couldn't have predicted. When I wrote Reinventing Australia, I couldn't have predicted how radically different our society would be just 30 years later.
I have to ask you, in your opinion, because some people are reflecting back on the good old days sometimes, it is a massive exponential change that we're underway right now in 2023. Are you seeing, do you want to reflect in your opinion on the positive and the negative side of these big changes?
Yeah, I'm no advocate for the good old days. When we go back to times that we think were somehow more tranquil or better, I mean, there are things about the past that we have temporarily lost. Chief among them, by the way, is our sense of strong connectedness to local neighborhoods. We can talk about that perhaps a little later in the conversation, but I think that's one very negative consequence of the changes that we've been through. We have become a more socially fragmented society as a result of many of these changes. Social isolation is now our number one public health issue. I mean, we used to say, without fear of contradiction, obesity was our number one public health issue. No more. Social isolation. Now, that's a very, very serious situation for us to have got ourselves into. We're not alone. Many Western societies are experiencing the same thing. But social isolation carries enormous health risks for people who belong to a social species, which is what we humans are. If you're socially isolated, you're at greater risk of loneliness, which we now recognize as a disease in itself, at greater risk of anxiety, depression, hypertension, inflammation, disturbed sleep, vulnerability to addiction, even reduced life expectancy, we now know, is associated with social isolation. So this is a major problem that we're facing, and it's in a way the central issue, I think, for a social scientist trying to understand contemporary Australia. But of course, on the other side, there are many, many things that have been changing for the better, like the real drive towards a greater understanding of gender and of gender equality. That's a big thing. And of course, this technology, which is allowing us to have this conversation, is undeniably brilliant. It has transformed our way of life, the way we work, the way we socialize, perhaps also the way we think, and that isn't necessarily a good thing. you know, our vocabulary is shrinking and our attention span is shrinking, and we're getting to the dangerous point of confusing screen-based contact with face-to-face contact. So that's another great worry about the present. But the technology is so brilliant, I retain faith in the human species that we won't in the end be mastered by it, but we'll make it our servant, and that will enrich our lives in many ways. But I think we're going through a bit more pain before we get there.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that you see that possibility, because I think that's where we need to be, isn't it? I was reflecting with someone just recently about, wouldn't it be nice if we had, you know, like with climate change, people turn their lights out around the world for an hour at night time to in kind of demonstration that we need to take care of the planet. And I was thinking, imagine if we had everyone power down their technology just for an hour to send a message that it will become our servant, not our master.
Yes, and we spend that hour face to face with someone.
Exactly.
Yes,
I feel
yes.
Like that's what I would hope to think as a social movement, that we, as you said, you have power in the people eventually to come
yes.
around.
Yes, yes. And we go through these phases like multiculturalism. I mean, it looked as though we were going to be a hopelessly divided kind of society in the 50s and even in the 60s, but that hasn't happened. Our basic humanity prevails. You know, the essence of our being is that we are one, that we belong to a social species. There are other kinds of species, but we happen to have either the good or bad fortune to have been born into a social species. So that sense that we need each other, that we're hopeless in isolation, that we need families, neighbors, friends, workplace colleagues, etc. We need groups, communities of all kinds to nurture us and sustain us, to give us that all-important sense of belonging that is so fundamental to the mental health, mental and emotional health of someone who belongs to a social species. That's such a powerful driver that I retain faith that it will prevail, that we will understand in the face of this astonishing technology revolution that it runs the risk of diminishing our very humanity, and we will have to push back against that.
That gives me so much hope to hear someone that's got so much experience through so many divisive periods of our history to that you come out thinking like that, because that gives me a lot of hope to keep pushing that message. So I'm really grateful.
And we do, of course, we do have to push it. That's right, Shalina. We have to be saying to our children, our grandchildren, our colleagues, etc. You know, that's, you know, you're talking to someone via a screen. That's not the same as face to face. You're not making eye contact. You can't make eye. I mean, I'm looking right into your eyes at the moment on the Zoom screen, but of course it doesn't look to you as if I'm looking, and no. What I'm actually looking at is a screen.
Yes.
The you know, well, you're a neuroscientist. Neuroscientists tell us that eye contact is the magic ingredient in human connection. And we've just got to keep reminding ourselves that screen-based contact denies us eye contact. Dr. Michelle Lim, a Melbourne psychologist, clinical psychologist, has coined, I think, a really important expression that's relevant to this part of our conversation. She talks about social hunger. And she says, if we're not getting enough face-to-face interpersonal contact, including eye contact, in every day, then we're likely to suffer social hunger. And the symptoms of that are very similar to physical hunger. I mean, if you don't eat enough, you get cranky, you get irritable, even angry. We know we're always more mellow after lunch than before lunch. Well, her point is it's like that with person to contact for members of a social species. And you can see that in social media, the heaviest users of social media. All the trolling, the abuse, the bullying that goes on in social media, partly because it's anonymous, but partly also because the heavy users are being deprived of sufficient social contact, sufficient eye contact, and they're cranky without even knowing why they're cranky. This is a big message, I think, for us to be conveying to each other, but especially to our young people, to alert them to what they're missing out on, and what kind of a dangerous trade-off it is to spend too much time with the screen. I mean, another contemporary fact which is relevant to that, I mentioned the epidemic of loneliness that's arising from our increased social fragmentation. One of the things that we know about loneliness, it's a state of mind. I mean, you can be lonely in a crowd, but loneliness has reached such proportions in Australia. The latest research on it says 32% of Australians Australian adults feel lonely most of the time. Now, the loneliest group in our society, where the rate of loneliness is, reported loneliness is 38%, are the 18 to 25 year olds. And they are the most connected generation in history. So we've got this phenomenon familiar to neuroscientists, familiar to psychologists and social analysts, this phenomenon of connected but lonely, where we're having this sort of connection, but not enough eye contact.
Yeah. And the other thing I'm noticing, Hugh, I don't know what your networks are telling you, is that even it's really affecting people's relationships. So they could be with somebody, but they're both on the couch watching the same thing. This is a in the younger generation, but they're talking to other people.
Yes, yes.
And also there's what I'm noticing too, this is just an observation. I don't have the research papers yet, but I'm sure this is all going to happen, is it's really affecting people's relationships.
Yes.
So intimacy and all sorts of other things.
Yeah, that's very true. There is already some research emerging showing that if relationships begin online, particularly through COVID, where people got to know each other via Zoom meetings and so on, when they do, if they've had 2 or 3 years of an on-screen relationship, when they do meet, it's very awkward. Because suddenly a person that your brain has only known in two dimensions is there in three dimensions, and suddenly there's this torrent of information that you get from face-to-face contact. I mean, the subtleties of facial expressions and body language and all that sort of stuff that we lose in screen-based contact. And people are socially awkward if their relationship started online as opposed to just being augmented by a bit of online contact.
Yeah, well, I'm actually seeing people physically together but online separately at the same time.
Yes.
And
yes.
So, and it's causing a lot of issues where, because of privacy and everything, that people are starting to assume that they're talking to someone else.
Yes.
Yeah, like it's just all sorts of stuff like that. I've just noticed that it's really affecting people's relationships and intimacy.
Yes,
in the
I'm sure that's right. And I'm sure it's playing tricks on our brain as well.
Yeah, interesting, because of the addiction nature of it. We weren't meant to be talking just about that, but it just seems to fit so nicely with what you observe about people and in 2023, how different it is even to 2022 in this respect.
Yes, yes, absolutely right.
So I'd love to talk a little bit about the good life. Arguing the good life is not about the sum of our security, wealth, status, postcode, career success, and levels of happiness. Do you want to elaborate for the audience what you mean by that?
Yes. The good life is a funny expression, isn't it? People say, oh, I think I'll throw in the job and move to the coast and live the good life,
yes.
By which they seem to mean a life of pure self-indulgence. Well, I have a totally different take on it. I think of the good life as a life of goodness. When you say, this is a good person, what we don't mean, this is a person who's devoted to pleasure seeking. We mean this is a person who's led a life characterized by goodness. And so what does that mean? Again, I go back to really just a point we've just been discussing, Selena, which is this idea that as humans, we belong to a social species. We need each other. The survival of the species depends upon our ability to create and maintain social harmony and social stability and to remain connected, to deal with this problem of social fragmentation and so on. So I think we can define goodness, the goodness of a life, as a life that is devoted to social harmony, a life that is devoted to civic engagement, being part of the neighborhood, being part of the family, engaging with the workplace as a human environment, not just a workplace, being prepared to make personal sacrifices for the common good. I mean, we talk, one of the problems we have right at this moment is that we've had 20 years of what I think of as the happiness industry telling us that, you know, the goal of human life is to be happy, that everyone's entitled to be happy and our children must be happy and so on. Well, that seems to me so vacuous and so misleading, misguided, such bad advice to give children. It's based on a very serious misunderstanding of an ancient Greek word, eudaimonia, which has been popularly translated as happiness, but which would, a better translation of it would be something like wholeness. That the good life, the ancient Greeks thought of the good life as a life devoted to fulfilling your duty to the community, being a good citizen, experiencing the full richness of pleasure and pain that comes out of engagement in human relationships and so on. And I think that's a very good framework for thinking about the good life. The good life is not about pleasure. The good life is not about, I mean, we'll have pleasure.
Yeah.
Good life is not about the pursuit of personal happiness. Pursuing an emotion, that's as crazy as saying I'm going to devote my life to the pursuit of sadness. I mean, you wouldn't pursue, emotions are little signals we get as a reaction to what's happening to us. We don't, if we're smart, we don't pursue them. What we pursue is courses of action that promote social harmony, that engage us with the community. I mean, putting it, I suppose it's in unfashionable language, but the good life really is a life of service to others. That's where the deepest life satisfactions come from, when we are devoted to understanding the needs of other people and responding to them. Of course, we have to respond to our own needs as well. If you're in an aircraft that's hitting turbulence or the oxygen level drops, the oxygen mask comes down and the crews say, fit your own mask before you help someone fit their mask. And that's true in life too. We've got to be fit. We've got to be functioning properly in order to be able to be of service to others. So we need a bit of time to ourselves every day to replenish our personal resources, to keep ourselves sane. We all need a bit of solitude, even a little bit of self-indulgence. But the purpose of it is to equip ourselves to be fully human. And to be fully human means to be engaged on that grand project of maintaining the social harmony that our species must achieve if we're going to survive.
And on that point, I think this is a nice time to reflect on tying back that original conversation around loneliness becoming a problem and social isolation, because I think what has happened is in Australia, as we became affluent, actually in the last 20 years, there's a thing being written called affluent neglect in children, but in ourselves. So focusing our effort around material gain and possessions and houses actually is well known and described to cause mental health problems. Like you can read any kind of book or any person that's about to die and you'll hear over and over again, I wish I didn't spend so much time focusing on that. And I think those two things go hand in hand.
Yes, it's a very important connection to make, Selena. I agree entirely. We have been in Western capitalist economies like ours, particularly over the last 50 years and most particularly over the last 30, we've been seduced by materialism. It's contributed to social fragmentation. It's contributed to economic inequality. I mean, I was talking with pleasure about how close we are to achieving gender equality, but we're a million miles from achieving economic equality. About almost 3.5 million Australians currently live below the poverty line, while we have more affluence at the top of the economic heap than ever in our history, more millionaires, all the stuff we know about property values and so on. We have become an economically unequal society, at great peril to our social and emotional health. What you say is absolutely true. The idea that the good life has got something to do with the wealth I've acquired or the possessions I've acquired or the value of my home or something. I mean, as you say, late in life, no one reflecting on their life ever says, gee, I wish I'd bought a third car, or I wish I'd put a second story on the house, or any of that stuff. When they reflect on their life, what they are much more likely to say is, was I a good neighbor? Was I a sufficiently responsible parent? Was I a faithful and loving partner? Was I a loyal friend? You know, those, it's all to do with our relationships. That's where the meaning of our life actually comes from our relationships with each other because of the nature of our species. Because we belong to a social species, relationships are everything. And possessions, sure, make life a little more comfortable and so on, but compared with the importance of our relationships, possessions are nothing.
It's unfortunate, isn't it, that this is not what we're taught when we're young, to be really frank. We're taught to, and there's nothing wrong with elevating your education, is really important, and being able to contribute in many ways and go to university, other things, and,
yes,
you know, all of those things do matter. But at the same time, I've noticed there's a big upswing in the focus and attention on people that do that over people that are actually contributing a huge amount of good to our country. And without them, we'd be really fragmented.
Yes, absolutely. I've had the opportunity just in the last few weeks on a couple of occasions to speak to senior high school students about some of these questions we've been talking about. And one of the things they often want to talk about, of course, is what they're going to do when they leave school. And it's interesting to hear the sort of things they say. And some of them, you know, do say very explicitly, I want to be rich and famous. Or, you know, yes, I want to make a lot of money. I want to live in a nice house and so on. But when they're talking about their jobs, you know, everything from I want to be a primary school teacher or a physiotherapist or a tattoo artist or a politician or whatever. But the message I always try to convey to them is, of course, it's important what job you do. You want to have a job that you enjoy doing and that feels like a worthwhile thing to be doing. But the main contribution we make to the betterment of our society, the main way in which we help to make the world a better place, has nothing to do with the actual job we do. It has to do with how we manage the relationships in our lives. I mean, if you're an academic, you have students and you have colleagues, and how you manage those relationships will have far more of an enduring impact on the character of our society than the subject you teach. If you're a parent, it's how you manage the relationships. If you're a doctor, it's how you manage the patients. If you're a plumber, it's how you look after your clients and your colleagues. It's the personal dimension, the social dimension of whatever we're doing that really will define our greatest contribution and our most important legacy.
I've been working in all these spaces and giving public presentations, and how do we get this back into deep conversations within families? I mean, honestly, in my work and what I see is this relationship piece has been really extracted terribly,
yes,
from families, from schools. We're putting in devices instead of the relationship between the teacher and the kids. We've got 4-year-olds now on learning from iPads.
Yeah,
that are mandated.
That's right.
Learn 35 downloadable apps that parents have to sign consent for their 4-year-old to be learning from. That's just happening now, and I think this is such a big mistake that we really regret.
I'm sure that's right. I heard a chilling story recently about a primary school that had a problem of a lot of kids who were a bit socially isolated, a bit lonely, and they started a thing at lunchtime called the Friendship Club, where kids would get together, play board games and so on, get to know other kids, all that sort of stuff. That went for a while. And then the person who was telling me the story said she asked her daughter, how's the Friendship Club going? And the daughter said, it's not called the Friendship Club this year, it's called the Digital Club. We all get together with devices and we're just, you know, on our iPads and phones and so on. I mean, this is an absolute outrage, but it's happening. And yes, I think there are two things that have our two major challenges in some ways. Materialism, which we've talked about as the great distraction from relationships, the building of social harmony, our concern with creating a more equal society and so on, but also a rampant individualism, which is actually fuel. I mean, this is a great paradox of the information technology revolution, Selena, that it promised that it would bring us together like never before. And it has done that, and it's facilitated our conversation this morning. That's terrific. But we weren't told at the same time that it would make it easier than ever for us to stay apart from each other, that these devices would actually come between us. And that has helped, along with a lot of other changes in our society, like our shrinking households, our falling birth rate, our busyness, our mobility, lots of other factors have contributed to what we talked about right in the beginning, the social fragmentation, which of course has also fueled individualism. We've seen the rise of the me culture, where people are more concerned about their personal identity than about their connectedness with other people. I accept that personal identity is very important to our sense of self, gender, ethnicity, religious belief, political convictions, cultural taste, all these things that contribute to our sense of self. But we've become obsessed by it. We've become so obsessed with the individual, with personal identity, that we've forgotten that all of that pales into relative, it's interesting and important to the individual, but relatively insignificant compared with the common humanity that we all share. And when we lose sight of that, our mental health is put at risk. Again, back to the core point we're discussing, which is we belong to a social species. We're acting as if we've forgotten that, as if we think we're a whole lot of individuals competing with each other and trying to do better and trying to satisfy my needs, my entitlements. You know, look how important I am, look how unique I am. Look at me. Well, that's got its place, but that's a tiny little bit of the human project.
Do you mind speaking to the voice? I think this is another very important point in Australian history, and I'm finding it really disturbing that we're not embracing such an amazing opportunity for our diversity to incorporate something very, very important. We've got 60,000 years of incredible cultural history that could really transform Australia into something magical, and rather we've turned it into a political nightmare. And I'm not really sure why we'd want to do that for the future of our country, because it's an inevitable, this culture has survived 60,000 years. It's not going to not survive another 60,000.
No, that's
it's an
right.
Inevitable thing. I just don't know why we don't want to embrace it as a part of our diversity.
Mm. Well, I'm certainly going to be voting yes myself. One thing I think I'd like to say about that, but that's not the end of the question. As you've said, we're talking about 65,000 years of history. We're talking about a very patient group of First Nations people who've said they'd like to have this opportunity of the common humanity we share with everyone, including the people of our First Nations, and how can we address some of the appalling injustices of the past.
So let's talk just quickly about your kindness revolution, because that's where I got to sit in the audience and watch you get interviewed around your book, The Kindness Revolution. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you came to, that's your most recent book?
Yes. And that's really, that really arose from my concern that we are losing sight of the very things we've been talking about, Selena, about the fact that we belong to a social species, that we really do need each other, and that neuroscientists like yourself say that we are hardwired for cooperation. That's our very nature. It's in our DNA to cooperate, which means that we are born with the capacity for all those qualities we need to cooperate. We're born with the capacity for kindness, for compassion, for mutual respect, for tolerance of otherness and all that sort of stuff. That's part of our equipment. Now, it doesn't mean that we are automatically kind from the moment we're born. We've got a language center in the brain. That doesn't mean we're born able to speak the language. We have to be taught the language. It has to be nurtured. And it's the same with these qualities that we need to fulfill our destiny as a cooperative species, we need kindness to be, and compassion and so on, to be nurtured, taught, reinforced, encouraged, and modeled by parents and teachers and neighbors and so on. But that's who we really are. And I think that we need to rethink the whole idea of kindness, not as some exceptional thing that we turn on special occasions, but as being a bit like breathing. Because we belong to this species, the human organism can't flourish without breathing. You've got to inhale and exhale. The human spirit can't flourish without the giving and receiving of kindness. What do I mean by kindness? I can define it very easily. And again, I'm coming back to what's turning out to be a bit of a one-note samba, this idea of humans as members of a social species. But because we're members of a social species, our deepest psychological need is to belong, to be noticed, to be included, to be appreciated, to be taken seriously, to be listened to. So I define kindness as anything we do, anything, to show another person that we take them seriously, that we've noticed them, that we appreciate them, not that we agree with them or like them or any of that's nothing to do with it, just that we acknowledge them. We take them seriously as a person. For example, when we listen to someone, by listening, we are conveying to another person that even if I'm going to disagree with everything you've said, I take you seriously enough to listen to your point of view. I'm prepared to entertain your ideas, even if I don't like them at all. Samuel Johnson, 250 years ago, wrote that kindness is in our power, even when fondness is not. And I think that's a really important reminder that we are, I think we ought to celebrate this every morning when we get out of bed. We belong to a species where we are capable of showing kindness to people we don't like. We're capable of showing kindness to people we could never agree with. We're even capable of showing kindness to total strangers without qualification. You see someone, I mean, you pass someone in the street, you say good day, and that can cheer them up temporarily, especially if they're on the brink of despair. Someone smiled, someone said hello, great, that's therapeutic. But we don't qualify people. If someone trips and falls, you just go to their aid. You're automatically kind. You don't say, hang on, before I offer to give you a hand, how are you going to vote in the referendum? Or, you know, what are your religious beliefs? Or what's your favorite movie? We don't qualify people. We just say, here's a human in need. I'll reach out and help. I'll show kindness, not for any reason except that I'm a human. I think of kindness as a unique form of human love. In fact, the old word, of course, the full word is loving kindness. We've chopped it down to kindness, but the original word was loving kindness. It's a branch of human love, but different from all other forms of human love. And this, I think, gets us to the core of my message in that book. All forms of human love are wonderful. I mean, romantic love is exciting and energizing, and familial love is powerful, and companionate love, where would we be without the love and affection of friends and so on? All of those forms of love have one thing in common. They're all about emotion. They're all about feelings. Same as if we use love in statements like I love chocolate, or I love dogs, or I love that book. We're talking about our emotional response. But kindness is different. It's the unique form of human love which does not rely on the emotions at all. I show kindness towards other people not because I like them or approve of them or agree with them or like their fashionable clothes they're wearing. No. I show kindness because we're humans. We are one. You're part of me, I'm part of you, we're part of the greater. We exist in this shimmering, vibrating web of interconnectedness, interdependence. There's no escape from it when we're human, and we suffer. We suffer mental illness when we try to deny that we are strands. We're all strands in that one web. So I think, you know, we've been talking about encouraging kids to see the difference between screen-based communication and face-to-face communication. We really have to pay more attention to encouraging, nurturing kindness in our children and in each other and in ourselves. Not to think this is some special thing, but just to say this is truly human. This is the fully fledged human being true to what Abraham Lincoln once described as the better angels of our nature. Well, one of the loveliest of those angels is our capacity for kindness. It does change the world. It could change the national agenda if we said, well, kindness will be one of the criteria against which we'll judge every policy proposal, whether it's social, financial, industrial, whatever. Is it kind? Is it fair? Would be another good question. But we're a long way from having understood that kindness is really the engine of our cooperative species.
Yeah, and I do hope that we get that we don't keep accelerating towards this speedy productivity notion, and we move towards more donut economics, because there's this amazing woman in the UK who's put out this book around donut economics and how there is only so much of a planet to be used. There is only so much that you can consume, and we need to start thinking in donuts, not in exponential curves of growth, because it's not possible, is it? And we're feeling the consequences of that. I was just wanting to add to what you were just saying there about the kindness piece. I think the other thing that's happened in what I'm seeing, Hugh, in my own little world of walking out every day when I go for my run, I'm noticing a lot of people on their own looking very distressed.
Yes.
And I was thinking, and so a few times I just go and sit next to them and say, she was crying, a phone was on the ground, I could see she was really distressed. And because I'm kind of aware of just how much distress is happening right now, I think it's post-pandemic too, of all that isolation. But I just sat next to her, and I just sat there and I just said, I just want to let you know you're not alone.
Yes.
And then she, no one does that, I think. And so people think that you're after something or whatever. And so this is the kindness piece we want to start bringing back to us. We were a bit like that once upon a time, I think, in Australia, a bit more community focused, maybe.
Yes.
I could be making this Pollyanna view. But then I saw another guy, 10 a.m., sitting on the bench, drinking alcohol, clearly distressed. Something had obviously hit his world. But he was sitting on a bench, and like, I just imagine our society, because there's lots of people walking up and down. Imagine if there was just two people or one person that just sat right next to him and said, tell us what's going on. And that could make all the difference to that person's life. And we're afraid to do that now.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I agree absolutely with, and by the way, it's a really lovely thing to do, go and sit beside someone and say you're not alone. I heard a really sad, sad story. I mean, it had a good ending. In Canberra last year, a young man attempted to take his own life by jumping off a bridge, and he survived. The person who pulled him out of the water said the first thing this young man said to him was, if someone had smiled at me, I wouldn't have jumped. He just felt so alone, so disconnected, so overlooked, ignored, not taken seriously. That smile, that little word, are you okay? Looks like rain. You know, can I give you a hand with that? These little connections can make a huge difference to the individual. And you're right. One of the things we're right to hanker after from our past is a time when the neighbor, when we understood the word neighbor. I mean, we understand all sorts of roles that we now play, but we often forget that because we're human, we are stuck with also having to play the role of neighbor. You live somewhere, There are people who live next door, they're your neighbours, and you're their neighbour. I saw some very, very disappointing research a couple of years ago showing that almost 50% of Australians said they felt they could not call on their neighbours to help out in an emergency. Well, we found during COVID you can call on your neighbours. People were very good and very neighbourly, typically, during COVID. But when people are saying they feel they couldn't trust their neighbours in that way, what they're really saying is, I don't know my neighbours well enough to know whether I can trust them or not. Well, really, what we need to go next door, knock on the door and say, hello, I'm Hugh, I'm Selena. I don't want to bother you. I just want you to know I live there. And if you need anything, give us a yell. Or I've got some spare lemons off my tree. Here they are. Those simple neighbourly moments are transformative. One of the most disturbing things that I've heard is people talking about in our big cities, I don't know my neighbours. Now, no one says, I don't know my neighbours with pleasure or pride, as though, isn't this terrific? I've finally reached the situation where I live in this house and I don't know my neighbours. Well, that's a very, very sad way to live. It's a neighbourhood that you live in. We wring our hands about the state of the nation. The state of the nation starts in the street where you live. The ripples from acts of neighborliness go out. That's how we transform the street we live in, the suburb, the community, the workplace, ultimately the nation. The culture shift we need is a culture shift that only we can make happen. There's not going to be a minister for kindness appointed, or we're not going to have the kindness police coming and knocking on our door once a month to check how often we were kind. Embedded in our conversation for the last hour has been this assumption that the world will be a better place when we are more cooperative, less competitive, when we're more communitarian, less individualistic, when we're kinder, more compassionate towards each other, whether we like each other or not is irrelevant. That all of that is a dream of a better society. And this is one of those dreams we can make come true, but only individually. We have to do it. We have to live it. Like you've done with the people you've seen on your morning walk or run, looking distressed. We have to respond to that. We have to take the initiative with neighbours. We have to not stand at a bus stop with other people, ignore them, but say, g'day, I think the bus is running late or something. Make a human connection wherever we can. That doesn't mean people will always respond warmly to our acts of kindness. But it does increase the probability that they will be kind to someone else in turn. The ripples do go out.
So as we're heading out, Hugh, can you give some advice to people that are listening that do feel disconnected and isolated in their relationships right now? I know you have some little tips that they can do, because social anxiety is a big deal, especially post-pandemic. So let's help people reach out if they're feeling like, give them some tools.
Yes. Reaching out is the big message, I think. There are as many stories of how people became lonely as there are lonely people. 25% of our households in Australia contain only one person. Creates a huge risk that many of those people will feel lonely. The main responsibility is for the rest of us to reach out to people who seem at risk of loneliness. If you're not a lonely person, be thankful, but take a look around your street. Is there someone living alone that you don't see very often? Have you knocked on their door? Have you seen if they need a hand with something? We need to reach out to them. But if you're feeling socially isolated, you can also take the initiative yourself by reaching out. Go and say, even say to a neighbour, I'm feeling a bit down. Would you like to come and have a cup of tea with me? People are going to respond to that. We're afraid to make that step, but once we've made the step, everything changes. When you go to a coffee shop, talk to someone. If you know there's a local community choir, join it. If there's a community garden, join in. If you can get into a book club, get into it, or start one. Doing things that connect you, particularly at the local level, to the community, is the only proven antidote to loneliness. We can easily be victimized by this. And one of the problems about loneliness, anxiety, and depression is they make us more self-absorbed. They make us a bit more reluctant to reach out. And as I've already said, we all have a responsibility to help those people, but they also can help themselves to the extent that they're able, just to reach out in simple ways, make personal face-to-face connections with other human beings. They don't have to be your best friends. They just have to be people you sing in a choir with, or work in a garden with, or anything. Anything that gives you human connection will begin to restore that all-important sense of belonging.
I'd found too, just the other day, I just tried something in my workplace where I said, these are my 2 30-minute time slots. I'm available for anyone to reach to just to have a chat. And immediately I had people signing up. So because I could feel this, so I mean, you're hearing so much about burnout and people not wanting to be teachers anymore, nurses, all the key parts of our society that are kind, that keep us together, so you can see that there's a lot of problems underneath somewhere, that where we don't want to commit to these kind of societal level jobs and professions that we all used to raise up as critically important. So I can feel there's something that needs to really shift and change quickly. And that does come from what you just said. We've got to start as humans reaching back in if we're in a good spot to help others that may be struggling and offer opportunities to connect and talk. The other thing I really like about, and as I would like to finish up by talking about your golden rule, because I think that's a unifying ethical principle, because sometimes having a moral compass or something to lay your hat on as a guiding principle in your life every day. Let's talk about that as something to finish up on, because I think it's a great. Because without that big compass, why would you be kind to people? Why would you bother? Do you know what I mean? I can see how people get not wanting to help. So, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, thanks, Selena. It's a good note to end on. If you go back into ancient wisdom, deep wisdom, in every culture, ancient and modern, every religious tradition, every philosophical tradition, you find at the core of ancient wisdom, or of wisdom, is this simple proposition, which again relates to the fact that we are interconnected, interdependent humans. And the proposition is we should treat other people the way we'd like to be treated, sometimes referred to as the golden rule. And of course, it is the golden rule. It's the perfect rule for people who belong to a social species who need to maintain social harmony. How do we do it? Well, we just treat other people the way we would like to be treated. And how would we like to be treated? There are universal answers to that. We'd like to be treated with respect. We'd like to be treated kindly. We'd like to be shown compassion. We'd like to be understood and accepted. Well, so would everyone else. And our big contribution to creating the kind of society we're going to become is the extent to which we can live by that rule. It's not always going to make us feel good. Sometimes it will, but that's not the point. It's not transactional. It's a way of life. It's, as you say, it's a compass. We take our bearings, determining what's the best course of action by reference to that simple rule. Am I treating this person the way I would like to be treated? If the answer is no, I'd better lift my game.
I'm very grateful for you, all your work, Hugh. It's just and all the contributions to our society in general, and this not just philosophy, but thinking. I think it's our only way forward, to be frank, if we want to sustain not just our country and our communities, but also the planet, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
The planet has got an end to it if we don't. So it's kind of clear that
That's
we
right.
don't really have a choice.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yes. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, Selena.
I look forward to meeting you in person too after. Lovely to meet you. Thank you for your
and
time.
And you. Thank you very much, Selena. All the best.